This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. The story you're about to hear is part of a special edition of The Pulse, The Science of the Cinema. If you want to hear the whole show, check us out on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. When you go to the movies these days, it doesn't really matter where in the theater you sit. Everything sounds great, from a whisper to helicopters in a battle scene. But what if I told you that one of the richest, most elaborate sonic experiences ever created in cinema took place over 75 years ago? Most people know Walt Disney's Fantasia with its whimsical animation set to big works of classical music, but this film was ground zero for surround sound as we know it. The Pulse's Alana Gordon takes us behind the scenes of this wildly experimental Disney classic.
This story begins in an unlikely place, the basement of a guy named Jesse Clapholz.
Hey, watch your step.
Okay.
I'm a semi-retired audio engineer living in Melrose Park, Pennsylvania. This is really a big mess.
At first glance, this basement is nothing special. It has old brown carpets, it's small, but it is an audio nerd's temple. It's lined with shelves of books about microphones, amps, mixing, stereo systems, acoustics.
Well, this is like the one of the Bibles, Cyril Harris.
Handbook of Noise Control.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Clapholz is a historian and former editor of the Journal of the Audio Engineering Society. And he has a treasure hidden down here in the back room. 9 filing cabinets. They make up the archives of John Volkmann. He oversaw audio at RCA, the company that brought us phonographs, records, the television. Volkmann was there from the 1930s through the 70s.
He was the top guy.
And he took meticulous notes of everything he did, saving handwritten blueprints, technical diagrams, even telegrams. Clapholz acquired it all when he heard it was going to be thrown out. He couldn't wait to dig in that first night after hauling everything back to his house. He came upon this one file, just a couple inches thick.
I just started looking through all the drawers and I came upon this Fantasia folder. And I was up all night just studying the folder. It was just so fascinating.
He shows it to me. It's labeled Fantasound.
I discovered America when I saw the folder. I was like, wow, this is really cool. These are some of the measurements he made. This is the installation manual for
installation. Clapholz flips through Volkmann's notes.
Pretty complicated, there's a lot going on.
They document the technical development of sound for the film Fantasia. It all happened back in the late 1930s. These days, Fantasia, with that mischievously cute, wizard hat-wearing Mickey Mouse, has become a staple in family households. As have those tiny sugar plum fairies and prehistoric dinosaurs. But to Clapholz, a historian of audio mixing, the film represents a lot more. In these behind-the-scenes notes, he saw the birth of surround sound. Fantasia was a major step at that time. It was only a decade earlier, in the 1920s, that movies really started to use sound at all, with the first talkies. The audio wasn't great, and it could be clunky.
Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
But then, heading into the 1930s, RCA, and Bell Laboratories especially, were moving the needle forward in major ways, experimenting with how sound was recorded and then played back. Both companies had been teaming up with a cultural icon at that time, Leopold Stokowski, one of the most famous conductors of all time. He led the Philadelphia Orchestra. Here he is in a 1972 interview with the BBC.
I love very much cinema. I think it's an immense and extraordinary medium.
Stokowski was a big innovator at that time. He was known for his fierce drive to find new ways to make music sound interesting and bring it to the masses. He brought the orchestra to radios, phonographs, and to film, occasionally conducting on the big screen himself.
Which one will you sing?
Traviata.
Traviata.
He was also known for his wild hair, tabloid romances, and strong personality. He wanted full control over every note, every detail of how the music sounded. A lot of Stokowski's big experiments with Bell Labs and RCA happened in the Academy of Music in Philadelphia. It's a beautiful old European-style opera house with plush red seats, a crystal chandelier, and gold-leaf tiers that's still in use today. Stokowski had turned the basement into a sort of recording lab that was full of equipment. Sometimes the orchestra didn't even know what was going on below them. Meanwhile, Walt Disney had been developing these animated shorts that were scored to music back in California. He was innovating with Technicolor and optical film that allowed for better recording of sound. Their two paths collided in 1937. The story goes that Disney met up with Stokowski at a restaurant in California. Here's how Disney himself recalled it in a documentary about the making of the film.
I was doing this Sorcerer's Apprentice with Mickey Mouse, and I happened to have dinner one night with Stokowski. And Stokowski said, oh, I would love to conduct that for you.
A partnership was forged. They went ahead and made The Sorcerer's Apprentice out in L.A., thinking it would be an animated short. But they realized it could be bigger than that, much bigger.
Disney said to me one day, you know, I like this so much, I'd like to make a long picture, bring in other
things. And before I knew it, I ended up spending $400,000 getting music with Stokowski.
And Bach and all the great masters.
And so Fantasia, a film that would consist of several animated segments, was born. They wanted to go all out. Disney had hoped to film it in 3D. And even bring in smells, so audiences would be showered with scents of flowers or even gunpowder during select segments. All of that proved to be too big of a lift, so he and Stokowski threw their energy into sound. But how to make an orchestra sound bigger than life in theaters was a challenge. Ultimately, they set out to capture the Philadelphia Orchestra, who, under Stokowski, knew how to create a rich sound in their home base, the Academy of Music. Stokowski, remember, had already turned it into a sort of recording lab. Again, audio engineer Jesse Klapholz, who later discovered those RCA Fantasound manuals.
The whole orchestra recorded all at one time in Philadelphia.
Nearly three dozen mics were placed around the concert hall stage.
So you could have strings on one, basses on another, percussion on another.
They were all then recorded on different tracks. And below them, engineers and technicians filled the basement, following the music in real time, even muting or silencing mics when their assigned section wasn't playing. That was the recording part. But Fantasound had another key element, post-production.
They had the eight recorders going and they just had a mixer.
Klapholz says it was in this process that engineers developed a lot of the behind-the-scenes sound techniques that are taken for granted today, that make sound move through space. That included multi-track recording, overdubbing, the use of click tracks, and the development of devices that could control and balance sound.
This thing was incredible. It was put together with gears and bicycle chain sprockets.
But in order to pull this off, Fantasia needed one final thing. A special playback system. Here's Stokowski in a documentary by journalist Steve Cohen that aired on WHYY in 1969.
We had in mind, or Disney had in mind, that what is seen on the screen in Fantasia sometimes had motion, and that motion could be reproduced also for the listener sitting in the theater.
A lot of elaborate preparation went into making this work. Here's the late Bill Garrity, Disney's chief engineer who oversaw Fantasound, speaking on that same WHYY documentary.
The theater installation consisted of three loudspeakers backstage and anywhere from 100 to 135 speakers around the sides in the back of the house, tied in to you.
RCA and Disney had to specially design and then haul in audio equipment to theaters. Because think about it, regular movie theaters didn't have big sound systems in place. Engineers rigged about a dozen places with the Fantasound system. It became a much-hyped Fantasia roadshow. The equipment took up half a freight car, weighed 15,000 pounds, and cost more than $20,000 apiece.
That's a lot. It was quite an undertaking, even by today's standards.
Finally, on November 13th, 1940, Fantasia had its world premiere at New York City's Broadway Theater. It was a big red-carpeted event. Attendees were taken to their seats by Disney staff. And then the curtain lifted. The New York Times wrote that motion picture history was being made. Music pranced up and down the aisles and boiled over the theater arches, as one paper wrote. It all culminated with the eighth and final animated segment. It featured the music of Franz Schubert, again, the late Bill Garrity.
We had a series of speakers in the back of the house, which we switched manually for the Ave Maria bit.
On screen, a pre-dawn sky and a serene horizon filled with colors of a coming sunrise. And then, coming out of the speakers, it sounded as if...
The orchestra played downstage center, the choir was on either right and left, and then the soloist came in from the back of the house.
People in the audience supposedly turned around in their seats, looking for the singer.
You're in the middle of a giant orchestra. It was designed to be able to play as loud and with as much dynamic range from the softest notes to the loudest notes with complete clarity.
It was way, way, way ahead of its time. That was stereo like there's no stereo today.
Time magazine described Fantasia as stranger and more wonderful than anything Hollywood had done. But Jesse Klapholz, the engineer historian who later discovered that copy of the Fantasound installation manual, says that success came at a cost. This seems like a hugely ambitious leap.
Tremendous, and that's why it just never caught on. It was just too expensive.
Fantasia, despite its revolutionary approach, was in many ways a bust. In a documentary about the film, Walt Disney described it as an artistic success, but financial failure.
That about did it, you know?
Disney couldn't turn a profit with its limited and elaborate theater runs. World War II was getting underway in Europe, cutting off box office sales there. And not only that, the reviews were mixed. Music critics took issue with Disney putting cartoons like Zeus throwing down thunderbolts to serious works of music. Klapholz thinks that original experience nearly 80 years ago would have been on par with cinematic sound today. Thing is, he'll never technically be able to know.
Could we ever listen back to that sound of the original?
No, it's lost. It's lost forever.
Technology has evolved. The playback systems were too much for general movie theaters to adopt, and so some of the equipment went to the war effort, or was lost. Which means true Fantasound, as originally heard in those theaters, is confined to the memories of those who, back then, were lucky enough to experience it firsthand.
Alana Gordon reporting. While we can't go back in time to the early 1940s to hear Disney's sound breakthrough firsthand, we actually do experience its legacy all of the time. Fantasia planted the seeds for the surround sound experience that has become a staple in theaters, one that many say came to fruition nearly 40 years later, thanks to George Lucas and the 1977 release of Star Wars, and what we might call a great grandchild of Fantasound, Dolby Stereo.